my name's Jenny. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is May 31st, 2012. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. I've been through the steps. I have a service sponsor. I do service. I pray. I meditate. I read literature. Those are the things that I do on a daily basis that help me to stay sober one day at a time. I am originally from a suburb in Pennsylvania, and I grew up with both my parents in a nice house, and I never wanted for anything. My mom was one of those drinkers who could have like literally one wine cooler for the entire weekend, and my dad has been drunk most of my life. And I say that to say that that has absolutely nothing to do with me being an alcoholic at all. As a kid, I'm also an only child. As a kid, I was always really shy. I was always manipulative, but it was often, my family often looked at that as like I was really smart. Like I used to cheat playing like the memory game where you had to like flip the cards over and match them. And I used to flip them over when one of my parents would leave the room and like memorize where they were. And then I would like throw a turn or two when they would come back and then like match all of them and win. And my dad just thought I was really, really smart until one day my mom was checking on dinner and she brought me upstairs. And my dad's like, why'd you bring Jennifer upstairs? And my mom's like, because she cheats. Like, and I was probably like 3 and a half or like 4 when I was doing that. I always kind of got a rise out of like being able to get other people to respond to things. So I like to like play tricks on my dad in particular. I guess I know now it's because he was drunk, so it was kind of funny because he was drunk, so the way he would respond. You know, I never really saw negative consequences about drinking with my dad and his drinking. He always looked like he was having fun. So I don't know if they just tried to hide things from me, but drinking never seemed like a bad thing to me as a kid. I had my first drink when I was probably around like 13-ish. Because we always had beer in the house, so it was easy for me to access beer, so I would steal beer from my dad. I don't really remember my first drink. I do remember one experience of when I stole some beer from my dad that should have been an inkling that there was something a little bit wrong and different with me in the way I was drinking, because I was only able to get one, and I didn't want to share it with anybody, and so I went home after school. I told my friends I wasn't able to get any beer, so of course, like, I lied from the beginning, and I went in my parents' room and I chugged it. I don't know why I had to drink it in my parents' room, but for some reason it felt rebellious. So like I chugged it in my parents' room and like danced around and stuff. So like I should have known from the beginning, like that's probably not a normal way to drink, even like when you're experimenting. You know, from the very beginning, I was a blackout drinker. I was a drunk driver all the time. I was considered the designated drunk driver because apparently I drove drunk better than my friends. So a lot of times people would like get in the car with me, and I would always find it mind-boggling because I'm like, yo, I could barely fucking walk. Like, why would you guys want me to drive you home? But then I'd be like, fuck that, light the blunt, put on the music, we out, you know? And that's how I lived like all through like junior high, high school. A lot of times I would get home and like I would know what party I left, but I wouldn't remember the route that I took to get home. And then I would have like moments where I'd like look at the seat next to me and be like, oh shit, I stopped at Wawa. And like have like no recollection of stopping, but very happy that I had food. You know, and it's a miracle that I never got into any real serious accidents driving like that. You know, there are a lot of people that I grew up that I lost to drunk driving accidents and to overdoses and stuff as a kid. And it's only a miracle that I wasn't one of those people. I was a party girl. I used to have a lot of pride in that. Like, I have this dual existence that started when I was young. I used to say I was studious and devious. So, like, I did really well in school. Like, I was in honors classes. I was in honor roll. I was in, like, the band and the orchestra and the choir. But then on the flip, like, I was always in detention. I used to get suspended. I used to get high before I came to school and after school and, like, during school. We used to take, like, road trips in the middle of the school day. And I totally justified it because I'm like, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do as a child. Like, I'm doing well in school, so, like, get off my back. I can do whatever else I want to do. And that's basically what I did all through high school. So my last year in high school, I experimented with a lot of drugs. I always smoked weed, too, like, from when I was 13. Like, I love smoking weed. I think I still really love weed. And then my senior year in high school, I just tried like a whole bunch of different drugs. I did a lot of ecstasy during that time frame, to the point that I was aware that my mind was no longer processing thoughts the way that it used to, but I couldn't remember like what normal was. But I was aware of the fact that my brain wasn't functioning right. And you know, that scared me. So it scared me enough that I was like, I'm just going to stick with like weed and beer because that's safe. And I also remember like my mom and my best friend, like kind of, they tried to like have an intervention with me about that. Cause like a lot of people, a lot of my friends got really distant from me during that time. And, my mom and my best friend were like sharing their concerns. And I like flipped out, was like, fuck you guys don't fucking understand. Like, you just need to leave me the fuck alone. Don't you know all the shit that I'm going through? And then like, I ran out the house. I don't know where I went, but I just like, I needed to run. So I just ran, until, you know, I just sat somewhere on a curb and started crying. And I don't really remember what happened after that. I don't really remember how I stopped doing ecstasy, or the other things I was doing at that time. But I went back to what I trusted, and that was weed and alcohol, because I felt like they had never betrayed me. Those were my best friends. I went away to college, and, you know, the party scene just continued. It just continued to, I know now that the progression was there and things were starting to get worse. Like, my blackouts were getting worse. At this point, around this time, my parents had gotten divorced and we moved to the city. And so I was like around new crowds of people. And the only way I knew how to make friends was like, you know, through drugs or going to the bar, which was kind of nice because I could get to the bar even though I was underage and nobody knew or nobody cared. So that's like where I met all my friends once I moved to the city. And at this point too, like my blackouts, I was getting like really aggressive in my blackouts. I was kind of like a joke when I was younger because like I was kind of aggressive, but like now I was getting a little bit more serious. Like I was getting into like fist fights with guys and stuff like that. And I never thought anything of it, you know, that was just part of who I was when I drank. And I was becoming really miserable, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I remember that was the first time that like that reality started to sink in was when I was in college. Once I finished school, I moved back home, but I couldn't stay home long because now my mom could see the way that I drank and I used, and that was a problem because she was all on my shit, and, you know, I couldn't drink and use the way I wanted to. So within, like, a few months, I moved out on my own. I moved into this horrible little apartment, but I was just so proud to have my own space because, like, I could get fucked up the way I wanted to. Like, the heat barely worked all the time. Like, I had the oven was broken. Like, they replaced it with another broken oven. People were like getting like, it was just like the neighbors were crazy. One day, like I don't know if they were like the ATF. I don't know. Somebody like busted in my door. They asked me if I was harboring this woman. And I was like, no, like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. Like that's the kind of neighborhood and apartment building that I moved into. And, I didn't see anything wrong with that. You know, throughout this whole time, I was dating drug dealers. I always dated drug dealers. I know now that I dated them because it was convenient, because I could get what I wanted all the time. And I dated a lot of guys who were, like, in and out of jail and stuff, like felonies and stuff like that. Those were the guys that I always was attracted to. I remember when I graduated college, I ended up in Atlanta picking up, like, bushels of weed with my boyfriend Lynch and his best friend Bananas. So just to give you a little inkling of the type of people I was around, that was probably right there. You know, so my life was, it was, I worked in the field that I went to school for a little bit, but then my disease was like, why don't you just work in the bar since you're at the bar all the time? And I was like, that shit makes perfect sense. So I became a bartender. And, you know, that's a dream job for an alcoholic. So, you know, I'm in the bar all night, and then we hit the after hours, and, like, I sleep in all day, and then I get up for a little bit of time and try to, like, get my life together and take care of things, and then I hit the bar. And, you know, this was one of the first times that I started noticing the powerlessness, where I would tell myself, like, I'm not going to drink tonight. And no matter what I said, I would always end up drinking. Or I would start saying, like, well, I'll drink, like, after midnight because that's, like, a safe time to start drinking. Even though, you know, as a bartender, it's illegal for me to drink behind the bar anyway. I got fired from a lot of bartending jobs because I would get drunk. But I always justified it because I'm like, I don't fuck your money up, though. So, like, why is that an issue? And, like, I keep a crowd of people in here. Everybody loves me, which fed my denial because they would always rehire me because, like, you know, I had a following. And my following would always be like, yo, where the fuck is Jenny? Like, she's not here. And so they'd always, like, bring me back. So I was able to justify that it wasn't a problem. And I also want to note that the bars I was working in, like, they were not nice bars. They were, like, bars in the hood where, like, shootouts were happening, where they had, like, security guard. Like, the bars that the only food they were selling were, like, 25-cent bags of chips and stuff like that. Like, those were the kinds of bars that I bartended in. And I loved it. You know, and I remember, like, being in there, like, looking around at people, like, man, these people are fucked up. Like, they got to get their lives together, you know? But obviously, like, I'm in there with these people all the time. And if I wasn't working, I was still in there with these people all the time. These were my friends, you know, my friends. But, you know, I needed to be around, you know, people who I could think and feel like I was better than them, so I could justify that, like, I'm not that bad because I'm around other people whose lives are, like, worse off than mine is. But the reality was I was just as bad and I didn't know it, you know, because alcoholism lies to me. Let's see. I'm trying to move forward a little bit. So I ran out of money. I had to move back home, which is crazy because I was making a shitload of money bartending. And I moved home. My mom made me go to outpatient because she was like, you're not living under my roof unless you do something. So I went to this outpatient. I was not willing at all, but I went just to appease my mom. And the only thing I remember was from this woman. And the only reason I started to listen to this woman was because she was talking about this, like, fluorescent pink leather, like, jumpsuit that she had that she wore to a club one night. And I was like, ooh, that sounds hot. I was like, I'll listen to her. So I listened to her a little bit. And what she said was that once you start to black out, you will always black out and it will always get worse. And that scared me because I knew I was blacking out. But then, you know, as an alcoholic, all that made me realize was like, oh, I got to figure my way around this. Like, there has to be a way to not black out. And then I started realizing, as I'm trying to figure out, like, what's that sweet spot of, like, not blacking out, I realized that my drinking used to be, like, oh, I was buzzed, and then there was, like, this, like, really fun, sloshy place of drunk before I hit a blackout, and I realized that that fun, sloshy place didn't happen anymore. And no matter what combination of drinking and smoking I put together, I could never find that space again. And the reality of that, I had to drink over and get high over to not feel it and not face it, which is how I dealt with all of my feelings and everything that happened in my life. Before my mom was going to charge me rent, I decided to move to Brooklyn to go to grad school, which is how I ended up here. I know now that that was a geographic. I know now that wherever I go, I bring myself. So as soon as I got here, I found all the same types of shady characters that I was hanging out with before. And it just continued to get worse. You know, but now I'm, like, around people that I don't know. You know, at least before I was around people who knew me. And so I was, like, dangerous. You know, I'm out here, I'm a woman by myself in the city that I don't know anything about. And my drinking just, it continued to get worse. The progression got worse. I ended up bartending out here, too. I remember, like, leaving class and, like, walking home and, like, making up excuses to walk past the bar that happened to have 2-for-1 every day from 2 to 8, you know, because somebody might say hi, and if somebody says hi, then of course I'm going to have to go say hello, and if someone offers to buy me a drink, it would be rude not to accept, and then it's 2-for-1, so, like, I don't waste, so of course I'm going to have the second one, and, you know, and then I'd end up just in the bar there all night, and then, you know, then we start banging shots, and then next time at the next bar. Then we pit stop at my house to get high. Then I go to the next bar. And then we go to the final bar where you could do drugs at that bar. And then I would mingle my way down the block to White Castle. and that all that happened within about a 5-block radius. And that became my life every single day. And, you know, waking up in the morning with, like, little burgers next to me, like, oh, I forgot one, you know. And then, you know, and, like, accepting the fact that, like, my apartment was a mess and, like, accepting the fact that the mice, they just live here, too, you know. They're in that room. I'm in this room. Like, everything's cool. And, like, felt powerless over, like, how do you, like, handle that? Like, not realizing, like, don't leave food out. So that became my life up here. And towards the end of my drinking, before I graduated school, I didn't actually graduate. I kind of fucked up. I finished all my classes. The last night of class, I went out drinking, as usual. I was out till, like, 5 in the morning, as usual. I had to go to my internship the next day. And I was afraid that I was sweating out tequila. And I asked somebody in the elevator about it. And he was like, no, you're good. So I go, and mind you, I was working with children at the time on the autism spectrum. So I go to set up my directive with the kids, and the principal calls me out of the room and was like, you know, there was a conversation that was overheard in the elevator. And I assured her that I did not drink before I came there and that I had never drank before I came there. I used to get high before I came there, but that was, like, regular. So they asked me to leave. I was, like, 100 hours short for my internship, and I therefore did not graduate. And I had definitely sabotaged myself in a lot of situations in life, you know, like just at the end, like a fuck up right before I'm about to achieve something. But this one really hurt for whatever reason. And I knew in my heart that I was going to have to do something about my drinking. Because at this time, I was going online and I was doing the 21 questions. And although I was drunk and smoking weed while I was doing it, and I was trying to figure out, like, maybe if I answer the questions in a certain way, like, maybe they won't all be yes. But they were always all yes. And so, like, I was coming to the realization that I had a problem and that, like, drinking was going to hold me back. And I was going to need to do something about it. I was hoping I was going to graduate and then do something about it, but, you know, my higher power knows better, and that I probably wouldn't have done anything if I had not screwed that internship up. So after that, I met my boyfriend. You know, I'm drunk, walking down the street, eating a sandwich, and start talking to this guy randomly, and he became my boyfriend. But this guy had been sober in AA for, like, 8 years, and when I met him, he was in a relapse. And I know now that I was watching what happens to a person when you know what AA can do for you, and then you go back out. Like, I saw what that pain looks like. And our relationship was absolute insanity. At one of the bars I worked in, apparently I like blacked out one night and started flirting with some other guy in front of him. And so he grabbed me by my ponytail, pulled me out of the bar. And because my pride and my ego were hurt, I pushed him down in the middle of the street, and I pinned his arms down with my legs, and I started beating the shit out of him. And then somebody was like, yo, the cops are coming. And I was like, babe, come on, get up. We got to get back to my apartment. The cops are coming. So I got some of my boys, you know, to help me carry him back to my apartment. And, you know, the cops stopped us. And the cops were, like, questioning me about a domestic disturbance. They said it was a girl in a purple shirt. And I looked down, and I was like, oh, shit, when did I put on a purple shirt? I was like, well, I could see how that you could assume that that might have been me. So, like, I ran my bullshit like I usually do, and I got us out of that situation. And then I was dog sitting at this place that was around the corner from a meeting in Brooklyn. And the reason I knew a meeting was there is because I was in therapy and my therapist had suggested that I try out a meeting. So I walked to this meeting, I looked through the window, I smoked a cigarette, and I went back to my neighborhood and got drunk that night. But as higher power would have it, I was dog sitting right around the corner from that meeting. And being the supportive girlfriend I was, I decided that my boyfriend needed to go to a meeting. So we went to this meeting, and I don't know what I heard, but I identified with something, and I was crying my eyes out. I was so hungover. I was, like, sweating and puking the whole time, and I was, like, a hot mess. And I know somebody now who saw me at that meeting, and a year into my recovery, she saw me, and I was talking about that night, and she was like, oh, my fucking God. She was like, that was you? She was like, you were one of those people that we were like, damn, she's not going to make it. Like, I really feel for her. And she couldn't even connect me to being that person based on what's happened in my life since I've been in recovery, because this program really is a miracle, and it really can change you if you really work for it. So I went home, and I told my family I needed help, and I found out my grandma had been saving money to send me to rehab. They had just been praying and waiting. So I found myself on a plane on my way to California, and I went to rehab, and that's what started my journey in this program. When I got back, that's the first time, when I was in rehab, was the first time I really listened to other people's suggestions, and I really accepted that, like, I did not know what they knew, and what they knew was how to live a sober life one day at a time, and that's something I had no idea how to do. And so I was open to listen. As soon as I got back to New York, I started making meetings. Every single day I made a meeting. I got a meeting list right away, and I carried my meeting list with me everywhere I went. Every single time I left the house, I had my meeting list with me, because I never knew when I needed a meeting, and I needed to know where they were. Whenever I went to a meeting that I liked, I asked people there to circle other meetings in my book, because I find that, you know, certain people who go to certain meetings, we like similar types of meetings. And I was getting phone numbers of women. I had a sponsor, because I had a temporary sponsor from that I had met in California, and I was calling her every day and checking in with her and talking about my feelings and what was going on and all the crazy thoughts I was having. And, you know, they say in the beginning, like, you know, to chase your recovery the way you would chase a drink or a drug. And I really took that suggestion to heart. And that's the way I've started my program from the very beginning. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, I wasn't working when I first got here. So, like, literally all I did was just AA. Everything about my life revolved around this program. And I am eternally grateful for that, because that foundation that I was able to establish helps to save my life on a daily basis today. You know, I was able to slowly build a network. I was afraid to, like, call women at first, but I would text them. And I'd be like, hey, this is Jenny. I met you at such and such a meeting. And people always responded to me right away. They would ask me what meeting I was going to, or like, oh, we're going to see you at this meeting tonight. And it felt good that people, like, you know, wanted me to be there. Although in my mind sometimes I was like, that bitch doesn't really fucking care about me. But I would still show up anyway, you know. And, you know, I went to a meeting and somebody told me to go to this other meeting. And that meeting ended up becoming my home group. I have two home groups. I have one in the city and I have one in Brooklyn. And, you know, the one that I went to in the city, they found out my 90 days was coming up. They're like, oh, you should celebrate your 90 days here. I was like, I don't even know what that means. And they were like, oh, you should just stay. And I was like, okay. I've learned that that's, like, one of the best things to do in recovery. When people suggest things, just be like, okay. Even if you don't know what it means, if you don't understand what, like, is required of you, just say okay. People will guide you through it, and, like, you'll get through it. And you'll learn something about yourself and about other people, and it'll be good. So right after my 90 days, my other home group, they're all about service. They, like, were signing me up for speaking commitments. I was all over the place doing speaking commitments, which was really great because I got to meet a lot of people. And because of that, like, most times when I go to a meeting, I see familiar faces. And that feels good to go in a room and see a familiar face wherever I'm going. You know, I started working my steps and everything, and I was real serious about them, and I did the best that I could on all of them. You know, the steps really are in order for a reason, and if you work each of those steps to the best of your ability, you know, my experience has been that, you know, they build on each other, and the one that you do, like, prepares you for the next one. And I've definitely been able to learn a lot about myself. I'll never forget realizing that most of the things that I was angry about actually had nothing to do with me. I was very angry when I first got here. My other home group, I'm known as the girl who wants to punch a bitch in the neck. I've been able to work through a lot of that stuff and let go of a lot of things. And it wasn't easy. You know, it's hard to let go of things that I held on to because I felt like I had to protect myself. Like, I had to protect that shy little girl inside of me. But I've learned to connect to a higher power and realize that, like, my higher power got my back. My higher power always has. Like, that's the only reason why I'm sitting here today. And you know, I don't have to protect myself in the ways that I think I need to. And as long as I keep that in mind and keep in mind that no matter what's going on in my life, I'm always okay. Like, in every moment, I'm always okay. In every moment, I'm right where I am meant to be. And I don't have to know where that place is today. And that's just come from living in this program. You know, this is a program of action. I've been taught that this is a program that we live. It's not just something that we do. And, you know, I have some sponsees and stuff now, and, like, I do a lot of service. And service has been really helpful in my recovery. It's really shown me how to interact with people. It's shown me how my character defects show up when I interact with people. It's allowed me to let go of the feeling like I have to be in control of everything. And it showed me how to really show up and be, like, a worker among workers and just, you know, be a human being, you know. Like, step work has done that. Like, I've recently been sharing in meetings that, you know, doing the steps has allowed me to realize, like, oh, I'm a person, just like everybody else. We're all just people, you know, because I didn't feel like a person before. You know, I didn't feel like I was worthy. And I still have those moments where, like, I get in my head and, like, I'm defective and I'm unlovable. I recently saw this thing that said my self-esteem has two levels. Either I'm a worthless piece of shit that deserves no love, or I am the queen of everything. Bow down before me, bitches. And I was like, I totally identify with that. That's so true. But, you know, staying connected is really important. You know, making meetings and making phone calls every day are important things. And I found that they're important to do because when I do them on a regular basis, when I really need to do them, I will naturally do it because it's just part of what I do on a daily basis anyway. Like, I have sober feet, and I will pick up the phone, and I don't have to, like, hesitate to do those things. And, like, today, I don't have, like, all the things that I think I should have or always thought I should have, but, like, my life is good, you know? And, like, I'm able to have peace and serenity in situations, a peace and serenity that I never even knew was possible. Like, all the things that I was looking for inside of a bottle or in a drug, like, I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm eternally grateful for that. You know, I'm really just grateful finally that I know what's wrong with me, because for so long I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I knew something was wrong. And what's amazing is that, like, now I know what's wrong, and I know that there's a solution for it, and it's a solution that works, and it's a solution that I do with other people. Like, I never have to be alone again unless I make that choice, because recovery gives us all the opportunity to make choices in our lives, and we can choose to do things that will keep us sober, or we can choose things that can put us closer to a drink, and I'm grateful that most times I have the willingness to choose to do things that are going to keep me away from a drink. Thanks.